is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Stars and Stripes on the Middle East. Marines newly deployed to the Middle East already are training for shipboard roles, protecting oil tankers and other commercial ships from Iranian aggression. News that comes a day after U.S. officials told some media outlets they were considering the possibility of such a plan. About 100 Marines, Stars and Stripes reports, have been training in Bahrain for specialized defensive teams that would travel briefly with commercial ships through and near the Strait of Hormuz, according to a U.S. official. Putting Marines and sailors on civilian tankers, an unprecedented step in the post-World War II, it does remind, however, of the First War, the period before the U.S. committed itself to the Allies. There was reason to arm the commercial ships. There was concern, grave concern, of German U-boats. But in this instance, it's Iranian fast attack boats and missiles. To help me understand this story and others, I welcome Benham Bentalabila, Senior Fellow of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Benham, I was surprised. Putting Marine in harm's way on a commercial ship, did it surprise you, and how has Iran reacted? Because this is clearly meant to be a blunt to their harassing of the shipment.
Well, John, it's a pleasure to be with you. You once again have pointed out a critical drama going on right now in the Persian Gulf and Strait of Hormuz. This is an evolution, make no mistake, of the U.S.'s efforts to defend international shipping, defend the free flow of oil in the Persian Gulf and Strait of Hormuz from threats that we've seen evolve over time for the past four decades. The most the U.S. did in terms of the creativity and in terms of the phasing of bringing its forces to bear in this domain was at the tail end of the Iran-Iraq war, the tanker war, when it reflagged Kuwaiti vessels and had American military ships follow commercial vessels that were flagged as American in and around the Persian Gulf and Strait of Hormuz while the bloody eight-year Iran-Iraq war was going on. And we know there were several brush-ups and fights between the U.S. and the Iranians during that time as well, and the Iranians ultimately did back down. I think the thinking here is that as Iran continues to harass both military vessels and commercial shipping and take more tankers hostage, even as its oil export volumes are at five-year record highs, traditionally the regime has done this as part of its larger coercive diplomatic strategy in the region, where it says, if we can't export oil, no one will export oil. But they're exporting 1.5, 1.6 million barrels per day, all illicit, by the way. And still, they're trying to throw their weight around militarily in the Persian Gulf and Strait of Hormuz. So by putting service persons on commercial vessels, the U.S. is drawing, in my view, on the logic of former political scientist Tom Schelling, of the threat that leaves something to chance, that if Iran continues to threaten these commercial vessels, there is the chance that it'll be threatening actually a vessel filled with service persons that will return fire, that may have a different threshold for the use of force, and in effect hoping to augment and deter and prevent Iran from engaging in this behavior. Time will tell if it's successful, but it is creative, it is new, and it potentially stands to change the dynamic that we've seen in a rinse and repeat fashion evolve in this region for some time.
I have seen reports over these last weeks of U.S. warships getting involved in the Strait of Hormuz. Is the Iranian harassment too overwhelming so that a warship doesn't answer? It's a very small space we're looking at, isn't it, Benham?
It's a very tight space. It's a shallow space. It's a highly contested space. There's local forces. There's foreign forces. There's different constellations of local forces and foreign forces. And ultimately, Iran's larger Persian Gulf strategy is to create a series of crises where it would be more politically conducive for the U.S. to exit than to double down and respond. And at that time, that opens up the Arabs to the Iranian kind of diplomatic overture of saying, we need a Persian Gulf free of foreign forces. And then once there is an external guarantor, an external balancer gone, Iran can have free reign doing what's the Italian saying? Politica del carciofi, politics of the artichoke, with each member of the Gulf Cooperation Council throw its weight around. So again, what is happening is novel. It is standing to change potentially some of the security dynamics that we know in the region. But again, time will tell if it works, because with the Iranians, who are very risk tolerant right now, it's not what you bring into the theater that matters. It's what you do with what you bring that matters.
The Stars and Stripes article has a photograph of your U.S. Marines assigned to Fleet Anti-Terrorism Security Team Company Centrale, stacking up at close quarters training in Bahrain. We can presume this is part of the deployment into the region. This is harm's way, clearly harm's way. We move to the bigger story of harm's way in Europe, which is the drone war going on in parts of Ukraine. The mystery here is Iran's presence. As I understand it, Iran is now boasting and illustrating its ability to build attack drones. Shahid 39 is my memory. I might have the number off. But there's more to it now. This is a story from NBC News. Recovered debris offers, quote, undeniable proof Russia is using Iran-made one-way drones in Ukraine. All right, that doesn't sound like too surprising, but the question is, Russia is buying the drones or building the drones? Do we know, Benham?
There's also an evolution there, John, and we're coming up on the one-year anniversary of when this thing was first publicly reported to begin with. Not when the U.S. warned about that, which was late spring, early summer of 2022, that Iran might be sending drones to Russia. In fact, Iran ended up sending various forms of drones, the Shahed 136, the Shahed 131, which are basically loitering munitions or kamikaze drones, what the article you just read calls one-way drones, basically a poor man's cruise missile. Think of it like that, lower and slower flying. And then a couple of UCAVs, unmanned combat aerial vehicles, like the Mohajer 6, which can return. It can drop bombs, essentially. Think of it as a much smaller plane. And in this essence, Iranian proliferation to Russia augments their long-range strike capabilities, keeps Russia in the war longer, and does so on the cheap. Traditionally, this was believed to be due to a financial relationship, the Russians might pay them. Then there was stories about, the Russians capturing Western weaponry and potentially giving it to the Iranians. That, too, was reported by the Wall Street Journal about 4 to 6 months ago. And then there's stories of a drone factory being built near Moscow, I think, in Yelabaluga, that would allow the Russians to indigenously produce these drones. Indigenous production of weapon systems has long been a problem in the Russo-Iranian military relationship, particularly in the 90s, when the Iranians wanted to indigenously produce weapons that the Russians just wanted to sell. But nonetheless, the Iranians, which have long been junior partner to Russia, are looking to step up their utility in this alliance. Again, the axis grows closer. You are seeing evidence of repainted over Shahed 136 drones as Garand 2 drones downed on the Ukrainian battlefield. And that story that you read adds DIA confirmation to the story that's been reported for about a year now, which is that Iran is supporting Russia through its proliferation of drones. And now when there are stories about Ukrainian sources telling the world exactly how Iran is shipping these drones, exactly, they mentioned four different airlines, including, I believe, Iran's national civilian airline, Iran Air, as well as some IRGC-owned or controlled or affiliated airlines. Production of drones in Russia would make our use of sanctions or our use of diplomatic and economic and political pressure against the Iranians harder to get off the ground here. So the more indigenization of these weapons you get in Russia, the harder to thwart the flow and the stem.
We're told in the news that Japan is protesting the reports of Iran cooperating with Russia and attacking on Ukraine. Is that significant to Tehran that Tokyo gets into the mix, condemning them for the suspect drone provision?
You know, there's a time and a place for everything. And when Iran traditionally, throws its weight around too much, inevitably there's going to have to be some kind of a balance or some kind of a return to normal. It has traditionally written off Northeast Asia, South Korea, Japan in particular, which are major U.S. allies and also dependent on Persian Gulf oil, as irrelevant in terms of political complaints. But when there is a political complaint, particularly on their territory, it does have to be taken seriously. It came while the Iranian foreign minister was in Tokyo, which I think was the first major Iranian visit after 2019, when then Prime Minister Shinzo Abe came for a historic visit to Tehran. So time and place clearly matters. And for an ally of the U.S., which the Iranians have written off as being more commercially minded, for them to offer direct, frank criticism and a rebuttal of the Iranian position directly to the Iranians while on Tokyo's own soil is, I think, a potential shifting of the winds there. So many not just one, are pointing a finger of accusation at Tehran.
In the next 2 weeks, the meeting of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, in Johannesburg. And the question I have is, Iran is looking to participate in some fashion. It is observed in the past. It is invited to Johannesburg. However, I turn the screw here. Is Iran offering combat drones to other nations besides Russia, specifically in the global south? Do we know of Iran selling or intending to sell attack drones? What is it, Shahid 139, anywhere in the global south?
Well, there already were long-established stories of Iranian defense industry ties with the likes of Venezuela. So there's an interest in getting a foothold in the Western Hemisphere. More recently, you've seen stories politically within Bolivia about their intent to actually get Iranian drones. I would actually not see that as manufactured. I would see that as part of a larger phenomenon in the global south of actors who may not meet certain standards to be able to get certain kinds of Western weaponry, but are seeing the relative success of Iran's low-cost, high-impact, unmanned aerial strike platforms like suicide drones, like the Shahed 136, like the smaller Shahed 131, as well as some other platforms. The Iranian media for a while now has boasted that I think upwards of 20 countries were interested in these drones. When the Iranians began to slowly introduce the concept of the Russians actually receiving these drones in their own press for their own domestic population, they had said that several great powers to several large countries were interested in their drones. That's how the Iranians began to open the conversation about, yes, they are proliferating some drones to Russia. But you point out a critical trend, John, which is in the absence of the 2020 UN arms embargo, which lapsed in 2020 and formerly used to be permanent, Iran may not just be proliferating arms, small arms, asymmetric military capabilities to non-state actors. It may try to move from proliferation to trying to elicit purchasers. And the battlefield success of some of these weapons, particularly with the Russians in Ukraine featuring Iranian weapons, may be enough to entice some of these countries in the global south to turn and purchase from Iran's robust domestic arms industry, which we know does have a lot of foreign touch points still, but is also still robust at home.
You remind me of the sanctions on the Iranian missile program, now up for review. And when we come back, what is the status? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Patrick.